for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In 1975, Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. started his work as chief counsel to the Church Committee, the group charged with investigating government secrets following Watergate. He says it was the beginning of a career-long interest in transparency in government. He explores the culture of government secrecy in his latest book, titled Democracy in the Dark: The Seduction of Government Secrecy. Frederick A.O. Schwartz is chief counsel of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. He joins me here in the studio. You are welcome to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. It's good to have you here, sir.
It's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And I'm sure many people hearing your name will think first and foremost of the toy company. Tell us about your connection.
Well, that was my great-grandfather who founded it. My grandfather ran it, but I never knew him. My father became chairman of the board, but was a private practitioner, a lawyer, and actually, when his father died, he gave up his clerkship with Oliver Wendell Holmes because he felt he couldn't leave his mother and leave the business, and so that was sort of unfortunate for him, I think.
So, but the F.A.O. Schwartz is still very much part of the company.
Yeah, they pay us, we sold it, and they pay us money for the use of the initials, and I've put that into a foundation for children. Me and my brother put it in a foundation for children.
Oh, wonderful.
To do mostly interns for young people working in sort of public interest places, but people in their teens. And they work for a year, maybe after high school. And the condition is they both help the organization and write a policy paper for during that year.
And how do young people apply for such a position?
They apply through the foundation, which is now run by my son, who's called Eric, even though he has the same name as I do, but he's called Eric and I'm called Fritz.
Wonderful. All right. So young people out there listening might be able to Google F.A.O. Schwartz
Foundation
and find their way to it. Your interest in secrecy started with the Church Committee. Lots of people listening weren't even alive at the time. Tell us about
1975, we were started and we worked through 76. It was the most comprehensive investigation of government secrecy ever in the United States and ever in the world, and that's still true. We brought out enormously important secrets. I'll just mention three. One was the FBI's effort to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide. Another was the CIA's use of the mafia, hiring the mafia to help them try to kill Fidel Castro. And a third was the NSA, or its predecessor, the Army Security Agency, for 30 years getting most telegrams that left the United States. Now, at that time, talking about myself, my focus was on secrets like those and many others, rather than secrecy. Because I felt we had to get out the secrets in order to make the American public want change. And if we didn't reveal dramatic changes, bad things, we wouldn't get change. But since that time, I've paid more attention to the subject of secrecy. And this book, Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy, tries to explain why we have so much secrecy, why much of it is unnecessary and wrong and harmful, even though it's important to recognize that some secrecy is legitimate.
Now, you've mentioned that one chapter in your book has to do with a prior agreement with Iran. Talk about that.
It was with Great Britain, and it was the first treaty that was passed by, accepted in the United States after our Constitution. The interesting difference from today, and basically we have much more secrecy today in general than we did in the first 150 years of America, but the basic difference is on this treaty, the public didn't know anything about it before it was taken to the Senate, and even when the Senate voted on it, the public didn't know its terms. They dealt with really important things like British frontier posts that were left over from before the Revolution, or trade with the islands in the Caribbean, or the British conscripting American sailors. Really important stuff. The Senate passed it by 20 to 10, which was the bare minimum to get two-thirds for a treaty, and passed a resolution saying nobody should know about the treaty until President Washington decided whether or not to sign it. Now, a senator from Virginia, the next morning, leaked the document to Benjamin Franklin's grandson, who was a famous and important sort of anti-government publisher of a newspaper. So it was published. And then it was extraordinarily controversial. It's not new to have things like this that are controversial. John Jay, who had negotiated it, he was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and John Jay was hung in effigy, and Alexander Hamilton, who had just finished being Treasury Secretary and was supporting the treaty, was stoned in New York City. So it was very controversial.
So this kind of keeping secrets goes way, way back.
Yeah, in my book, I take it back to the first lines of Genesis, and where I say in the first line of chapter one, which was, in the beginning, ... there was secrecy. And I use how Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden because they sought knowledge. And then God also destroyed the Tower of Babel because that was being built toward heaven to acquire knowledge. And I say from that, powerful people have always sought to limit information going to ordinary people.
So the church committee, tell us how you became chief counsel.
I knew nothing about intelligence. I didn't know a single senator. And I got a call asking me if I would be interested in doing the job.
From?
It came from a man called Burke Marshall, who'd been the assistant secretary of the assistant head of the Justice Department for Civil Rights, and then had been general counsel of IBM, where I had worked with him on a big case. And I'd also worked with him at the Vera Institute of Justice, which does criminal justice reform. And the committee had asked a man called John Doerr, who would run the impeachment inquiry against Richard Nixon, who he would recommend. And before John made a suggestion, he spoke to Burke. They were very close. And I believe that's how I happened to be asked. And when I was asked and went to meet Senator Church, I said yes right away. I was really interested.
So it was the impeachment or the resignation of Richard Nixon that actually led to the creation of the Church Committee.
Yeah, I think that was one example of what was happening in the early 70s and mid-70s, which was the beginning of a disillusion with government. And Nixon's very bad behavior and resignation was one part. The Vietnam War was another. And also there were some leaks that had begun to become more common about how the CIA, for example, had infiltrated the National Student Authority, and how that was in Rampart's magazine, and how the CIA was acting domestically against anti-Vietnam dissidents. That was in the New York Times by Seymour Hersh. So it was a combination of things. And then we were lucky that J. Edgar Hoover was dead. Had he been alive, his power, his willingness to smear people, I think would have made it much harder. And we were lucky that Gerald Ford had taken over from Richard Nixon because Nixon had abused secrecy. And so Gerald Ford was in a position where he couldn't appear to be frustrating our investigation. So all those things helped.
Fritz or Frederick
A.O. Schwartz, Jr. No, Fritz is the one I like.
Schwartz, Jr. He is the author of a new book. It's titled Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. He is chief counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. He was chief counsel for the U.S. Senate's Church Committee. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more, take your calls, your email. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college and career and supporting innovation that can improve public schools at gatesfoundation.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
If you just joined us, Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. is with me, the author of a brand new book titled Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. He prefers his nickname Fritz, which I shall call him. And in the book, Fritz, you say you were particularly revolted by the FBI's treatment of Martin Luther King Jr. Tell us.
Well, you know, it was known they'd done some bad things, but not nearly what we found out. I mean, we found out, let's just give two things. The afternoon of his I Have a Dream speech, the FBI met in the bowels of their headquarters office and resolved to destroy King, saying he must be knocked off his pedestal. They did a great deal to try and accomplish that end, the most dramatic action of which was they wrote him a letter which was disguised as if it had been written in language that not by an FBI agent, but which sent to him a tape recording of tapes that had been taken when he'd been in hotel rooms. And the tape recording was filled with, "We're going to expose you. You will be exposed. You have only one thing left to do, and you've X days to do it." The days were the number of days before he was to get his Nobel Peace Award. And the King family and Martin Luther King And some outside observers who later learned about it said it was designed to get him to commit suicide.
Under whose orders at the FBI was that letter sent?
It was sent under the auspices of William Sullivan, who was the head of their domestic intelligence division. But J. Edgar Hoover was fully behind the efforts to destroy King.
And you also offer a footnote about Senator Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, it was interesting. The senators, there were 11 of them in our committee, 6 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and it was not partisan. The most important finding we made was that every president from Franklin Roosevelt through Richard Nixon, that's 6, 4 Democrats, 2 Republicans, had abused their secret powers. When we started, the senators asked me to make a list of things we should cover because we couldn't cover everything if we tried that. Impossible. So I gave them up with a list. I don't remember. Maybe it had 15 on it, and we probably added 5 more or something. The only objection to one item on the list was from Senator Goldwater, who objected to our investigating the FBI's treatment of Dr. King. This, of course, before we knew very much about it. And Senator Church said, why? And Senator Goldwater said, because they rioted when he was killed, and we don't want to stir them up again. So we went ahead, and we finished the investigation, and I gave a briefing to the senators of what the FBI hearings were going to show before we put them on in public. And I described the suicide tape, and I said, neither I nor anybody else on my staff, on this staff, has listened to it because we didn't need to listen to the tape to understand the wrong that had been done, and to listen would add to the violation of the privacy of the King family. At this point, Senator Goldwater objected and said, well, I think Fritz is wrong. I think we should take that tape and we should play it on national television. I thought that was really wrong, surprising, very wrong, and particularly surprising from someone who generally was known as a advocate for privacy. We went ahead and of course, we did not play the tape on national television. That was really, I would praise all of our senators, unfortunately, except for Goldwater, who I thought would be good because of his interest in privacy and who was not as attentive to the work as the others, and certainly, I think, made a terrible mistake when he said we should take that tape, which never should have been made, and play it on national television. And that's never been said before, but I told it to you here.
The tapes, I gather, would have greatly upset the wife of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I think that was one of their purposes, too.
Wow. But in this book, you say, some secrets are okay. The question is, how do we as a general public distinguish between what it is the government says is okay to keep secret and what we later find out they have kept secret and makes us absolutely furious to find out?
Yeah, I think the tricks are understanding more about what the secrecy system is. That's what I try to do in this book. Understanding why it's so hard to change. That's really the thrust of the word seduction in the subtitle. So you need to have understanding first. And then you have to analyze, starting with classification, and you can think through what are the normal reasons for secrecy. And then you, when you do that, if you think hard enough, you'll say that's a good reason, but there are times it isn't a good reason. Let me just give 2 examples of a but. One would be normally you're not going to make public weaknesses in your military. And I illustrate that way back to George Washington, where we had inadequate gunpowder when the British were in Boston and he was outside. And so he fooled the people and certainly didn't make that public. Now, there are times when, however, it's a good thing, like in the Iraq War. The IEDs, the bombs that went off under vehicles and blew up the bottom of the vehicle and blew up the bottoms of the soldiers in the vehicles. So we had inadequate armor under the vehicles and inadequate body armor for the soldiers. And revealing that problem, which I think USA Today did, served in, and you can see this in Bob Gates's memoir, served to make the military work harder to try and fix the problem. Another would be the names of informers or spies. Now, it's almost always wrong to identify a person who's an informer or a spy because it puts at risk their lives, and it's simply not right or fair to do. Now, in the Powell speech that helped lead up to the
Colin Powell
speech,
Secretary of State.
Yeah, that helped lead up to the war in Iraq and talked about Hussein making biological weapons, relied almost entirely on information from a person whose code name was Curveball. And Curveball was an Iraqi who had relevant experience, who later confessed that everything he said was untrue, but who the Germans had interrogated, the Americans had never interrogated him, and we used his claims as the basis for Powell's speech. If not his name, but the weaknesses in his story had been revealed, I think probably Colin Powell would never have made that speech, and quite possibly we would not have gone to war. Then I want to say one other thing about secrecy. It's not only classification that's a problem. Well, that's an enormous problem. We classify now about 100 million documents each year, which is up 950% from the beginning of the century. That's largely due to email, but still the numbers are gargantuan. But in addition to classification, there are problems of the attitude secrecy creates. And I illustrate that in a number of ways, including 9/11.
Which is where I want to go, because you say it's time for a new church committee to investigate.
Yes, it is. And I think if I could make one preliminary thing before that on 9/11 itself, the CIA actually gave the White House a number of very, very strongly worded warnings about the likelihood that bin Laden was going to do something, quote, spectacular, very, 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 very much bigger than anything before and resulting in numerous casualties. And I'm quoting from memory all those words. Now, there was nothing wrong with the White House and the CIA having classified as top secret those reports in the first instance. But if they had revealed the gist of those reports, it is likely, and I try to explain this in the book, that 9/11 would have been prevented. But the main point is, once something is classified, people stop thinking about whether it should still be classified. So I interrupted your question.
No, but I'm thinking also about that relationship between the FBI and the CIA and how each organization had its own delving into what might happen, but never made connections.
The silos, And that the 9/11 Commission exposed very effectively, and the 9/11 Commission, for reasons that I understand, although I think it'd been better if they criticized the White House on not revealing. And the metaphor I use is if the FBI and the CIA were stovepipes. I think that's the 9/11 Commission uses that metaphor, or silos. The White House was the furnace. And if the White House had revealed the gist of these warnings to, most importantly, the people in the government, lower-level people who were already worried about people of investigative interest taking flying lessons, and to the general public, I think there is a reasonable chance that we would have not had a 9/11. But the story anyway illustrates the point that once something is secret, people stop thinking about whether it should continue to be secret.
Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr., he is the author of a new book. It's titled Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So many questions about why immediately after 9/11, a plane filled with Saudis was allowed to leave this country. Still, no clear answers about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that fact, and I know the report has not been released, and I know that former Senator Graham of Florida is pushing hard that it should be. And indeed, why shouldn't it be? Because we have to get over the idea that you can't trust the public with information. We have to get over the idea that things that might be embarrassing should be secret forever. There's no reason why that should be secret now. I mean, let's know why that wasn't
released. If 19 of the perpetrators mm-hmm. of 9/11 were Saudis, shouldn't the public be informed as to why?
As to why they were allowed to leave. Yes, they should. And indeed, there may be respectable reasons why Saudis were allowed to leave. But if the reasons are good, why shouldn't they be known? And it's an example of the habit of just allowing secrets to go on and on forever. That's even more of a problem, in my opinion, than initially creating a secret. It's how long, letting them last so long. If you had to, you should fix both. But if you had to fix just one, work on the don't let them last so long.
We did have the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on torture. Did that go far enough?
I think the Dianne Feinstein and her colleagues should be complimented for that hearing and their report, although only the 500-page introduction has been released. The 6,000-page full report has not been released, but I think they should be complimented about it. I thought they could have pushed the government harder. Pushed the Obama administration harder. You know, under the rules, the Senate can release something even though the president has not agreed to declassify it. I thought the president, Obama, who had a mixed record on secrecy. First, let me say a couple of good things. He released the original torture report and the legal opinion that justified it, that never should have been secret in the first place. He has released much more information on our nuclear capacities, and he's also improved the release of the budgets of the intelligence agencies. On the less positive side, he's been unusually hostile to lawsuits that have been brought by people known not to have been terrorists, but who were treated as terrorists and tortured, and they've imposed the so-called state secrets doctrine more than ever before. and also journalists and leakers have been subjected to the awesome penalties of the Espionage Act, which is misplaced. Now, that doesn't say that every leak was appropriate, but it does say that the punishments have been too severe and there have been too many threats against journalists also.
The book we're talking about is titled Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. I'm speaking with the author, Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Tote Maritime is working to reduce emissions across their fleet by building container ships that run on natural gas. Learn more at thinkaboutit.org. From CFP, on behalf of certified financial planner professionals, committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice to help plan for major life events and reaching financial goals at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
When composer Philip Glass first started performing his music, it was so different and new that sometimes audiences would get angry. So angry, they'd throw things.
If they threw apples and oranges, that wasn't so great. But if they threw an egg, it isn't so bad, because the eggs would just break. No, that could be...
He's our guest on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Welcome back. Our subject today, secrecy, a new book by Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr., titled Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. Before we open the phones, let's look back to the role secrecy played in the dropping of the atomic bomb.
Yeah, now... As I say in my book, whether the dot bomb should have been dropped on civilians is outside the scope of the book. But what I look at is, and again, assuming we were going to drop the bomb, it was legitimate to have secrecy about where and when. I mean, you're not going to reveal when you're dropping a weapon or using a weapon. But the problem was that after the people had decided way back at the end of May of 1945 to drop the first bomb on a crowded Japanese city in order to terrify the Japanese public. Today that would be thought of as a war crime, but it wasn't then. But after they decided that, two things happened. One, the bomb was proven to be more powerful than they had expected. And two, there were more bombs available than they had thought there would be. They never rethought the idea of starting by bombing a crowded city. And they also gave authority to General Groves, who designed the bomb. And just as a little side note here, he decided to drop it in Hiroshima right in the middle of the city and not where the military facilities were, because he said, I want to put it in the middle of the city and then we can get better scientific proofs of how powerful the bomb is. Now, that's not a reason for deciding where to drop a bomb. But going back to the people who were really in charge, once they made the decision to drop it on a crowded city, they stopped thinking. And I make the point in the book, again, saying it was legitimate to have secrecy, but you should know when you've made a secret decision that you've lost the benefit of the public being able to comment, criticize, suggest alternatives. And therefore, you should remember to continue to think. And I think had they continued to think, they would have said, well, if we've got more bombs and if it's more powerful than we thought, let's not start by dropping it in a city. Let's start by dropping it on a military base. But they'd stopped thinking. And the point I make is that one of the seductions of secrecy is it leads you to stop thinking.
And it leads to, or could lead somehow, to the destruction of the democratic way of arriving at solutions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the purpose of my title, main title, Democracy in the Dark. And if you think about it, what are the founding hymns of America? Let's take the Declaration of Independence and Gettysburg Address. Declaration of Independence has in it the phrase that a just government is based upon the consent of the citizens, consent of the people. Now, the people can't consent in any meaningful way if they're uninformed. And then Lincoln, in his beautiful Gettysburg Address, says we shall make sure that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. Again, if we're to have a government by the people, we must not keep the people in the dark, or they can't do their job.
Time to open the phones. First to Loveland, Ohio. Hi there, David. You're on the air.
Thank you. I admire this your guest very, very much. I just I have a definition of obscenity or evil or pornography, if you will, which is twofold. The first part most people would agree with, that is when private things become public, that's obscene. What most people would not admit is that when public things become private, that is becoming even more obscene. Thank you.
I think that's a nice phrasing, and it's picking up the theme of this book. That I like your phrasing. Very good.
Let's go to Mark in Oklahoma City. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Now that Republicans in Congress are once again investigating the Clintons, in this case Hillary Clinton, who isn't even in office for supposedly being too secretive, I wanted to ask Mr. Schwartz if I'm remembering correctly that Gerald Ford vetoed the Freedom of Information Act, and George one of the first executive orders that George W. Bush signed when he became president in 2001 was to block or delay the mandatory release of his father's presidential papers. And also, am I remembering correctly that there was never a congressional investigation of the allegation that the Ronald Reagan presidential campaign cut a secret deal with the Ayatollah Khomeini to delay the release of our hostages?
I think those are all very, very important points. The Ford did veto FOIA, the improvement of FOIA, and he did so at the advice of Richard Cheney, who was his chief of staff. But I want to make a broader point. I don't think secrecy is an issue that divides Republicans and Democrats generally. I think you both have strong strains within their party that worry about too much secrecy. For example, after the Snowden revelations, the House came within about 10 votes of passing a bill to close down the NSA metadata program. And it was sponsored by a very conservative Republican young congressman called Amash, and co-sponsored by John Conyers, a very liberal, longtime Democrat from Detroit. And I give a number of other examples of where the issue of secrecy, of excess secrecy, is not a partisan issue. I think that's one of the two reasons why we can have some hope that there are going to be changes in cutting back on excessive secrecy.
He also asked you, he raised the names of Hillary Clinton, and I'm wondering how you regard the withholding of emails thus far.
Yeah, I think it's not been helpful to her. I don't think I don't think her explanations have been very good. There's a pattern that's a big historical point about papers. From George Washington through Richard Nixon, presidents believed they owned their papers. Therefore, they could destroy them. They could destroy part of them. They could keep them and then sell them to the government. Then, as a consequence of Watergate, the Presidential Records Act was passed that said, no, the people own government papers. And on the subject of emails, after that Presidential Records Act was passed, the Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton administrations all argued that emails were not covered by the Presidential Records Act, and they all lost. So emails are covered. So then the problem is, how does one decide what is a governmental document? And I think it's difficult for her to defend destroying everything else. I mean, suppose there's a document which is not written to a foreigner or to a member of the State Department or to anybody else in the government, but is written to a colleague who's not in the government, but it's commenting on an important governmental issue. Surely one doesn't want that lost to history. Doris Kearns Goodwin made the point that if these pieces of personal motivation are vital to ultimately writing a good history, and that's a question more of how we don't want history to be encumbered than it is what the law provides.
To Jacksonville, Florida, let's hear from John. You're on the air.
Diane, thank you so much for your show. I always enjoy it.
I'm glad.
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Schwartz, thank you for being so open about your feelings about this stuff. Here's something that happened to me, and maybe you'll have a comment about it, I hope. In 1969, the summer, I was in the U.S. Marine Corps. We were getting ready to deploy on a Mediterranean cruise. They lined up our entire company for a VIP inspection in front of railroad tracks. They told us the flatbeds were going to come by with bleachers with political, business, and military leaders on it to review our troops. Before the train passed by, they gave instructions to people to accept insignias that upgraded their ranks and had them removed, like a sergeant removed, put on staff sergeant. Second Louis removed their bars, put on First Louis bars. There were all kind of ranks that were upgraded just for this review. And they instructed us, you will never discuss this. And after the review is passed by, you will revert back to your original ranks. Do you have any explanation why they would have done something like that?
I don't. I mean, I guess the you will never discuss it is said too often. But I don't have an explanation for why they would think that was worthwhile doing.
Do you, I gather, still have some feelings of guilt about that, John?
Well, because it was illegal, you know, for them to falsify ranks like that for this review. And the odd thing was, I later became a broadcaster, a journalist, and I watched a film called The Selling of the Pentagon, which was a hand slap on CBS for falsifying an interview that they did with Westmoreland, you know, changing his reply.
I remember that.
Yes. And while watching that film, in that film, you will see a view from a flatbed car, a camera going past these troops that are on review. And when I saw it in class, I went to the library and checked the film out so I could play it back in slow motion. And oddly enough, it was my inspection.
There it was. Well, that's quite a story. Thanks for sharing with us. And let's go to Jim in Wellington, Colorado. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the program.
Good.
Sports. My understanding from reading much in American history is that in the very beginning, the founding fathers and others had a bit of a disdain for democracy itself in terms of a form of government, and that was instrumental in helping set up a republic. And I wondered from your research if you believe that that was because of a lack of trust of the common man, which I think may still prevail today and is causing so much of the secrecy over the years that we observe. Thank you.
Well, certainly a lack of trust in the common man or woman is one of the reasons why so many people support secrecy. They simply feel the public is not equipped to deal with difficult issues. That is a fundamental rejection of American democracy. At the beginning, I'd say it was a dispute more than a decision, and it was the some of the founders wanted to have the British system where the public played no role between elections. They just voted, but they weren't involved at all. And the decision was made, and by the time of Jefferson, this decision was cemented, to let the public, that by that they meant white men, but let the public be involved, white men even without property. And originally, some people tried to limit voting to people with property, but The decision was made that we want to have the public involved, and to do that, they have to be informed.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And here's an email from Judy in New York City, who says it's interesting to compare increased secrecy with diminished privacy. Democracy in the dark is euphemistic tyranny that assumes people in charge know best. But since secrecy benefits those in power and they decide what should be secret, aren't we stuck with it? What can we as citizens do?
Well, I think we can understand how we're being deprived of our rights of members of a democracy. Let me make a comment which is triggered in my mind by your question, your email, about Mr. Snowden, who I think actually did a great service to help the nation. And I make a point in the book that I think the discussion, which has been focused on privacy and legality, which are both extremely important, but I think the principal fault of the George W. Bush administration when it instituted the NSA's metadata program and then the Obama administration when it continued it, the principal fault was not having a democratic dialogue about it. There was nothing about that program that had to be kept secret. It's not going to change Al-Qaeda's behavior to know that we're collecting metadata. They think we're collecting their voices. So there was no reason not to have a democratic discussion. And I think the main problem was not privacy violations, not legal questions, but the violation of democratic principles in not having a discussion about what the government wanted to do.
So if you had your choice, what would you do now with Mr. Snowden?
I would not threaten Snowden with these amazingly unfair penalties that were imposed on Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning was not as careful as Snowden, and he let things be released where names, for example, were revealed. Snowden was very careful, and he did it through journalists who he knew were going to be careful and not reveal things that would injure individuals. So I think Snowden is ought to be seen as someone who took a step that might or might not have been legal, but which actually helped the country.
Democracy in the Dark, the Seduction of Government Secrecy. Frederick A.O. Schwartz is the author and my guest today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too. I enjoyed it very much.
It's a great pleasure. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Urblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.